this is Mel, and I'm watching the Cubs lose from a rooftop, but you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Mel. I hope you enjoyed your experience on the rooftop at least. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. Happy to be here with you today. This is show number 817. And of course, what we do here on this show is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Say hello online, all the usual spots, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Maybe there's something else I'm forgetting. Who knows? Get the podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the WGN Radio studios today. So good morning to Bob and good morning to you listening to this program. You heard Mal there? Up on a rooftop? It's been a while since I've been up on a rooftop outside of Wrigley Field. It's been some years, actually. I, for the first time since, I guess, before the pandemic, went to a Cubs game earlier this week, and the Cubs got rocked, of course. It wasn't particularly great baseball on the part of the Cubs, but a friend of mine had a ticket, and so he said, "Do you want to go?" And I said, "Sure," and so we went, and, you know, I love Wrigley. Don't get me wrong, but the area around Wrigley, and I know that this is nothing new, right? It's been getting jazzed up, dressed up around the ballpark for years with the influx of bars and restaurants. So I get that. But, you know, I haven't been there in a few years, and I went there and it was like, I don't know if it was like Vegas or what, but there's a hotel across the street from Wrigley. There are all these restaurants. Which is, I find interesting, like a lot of these restaurants that opened up across the street from Wrigley Field, their original location, like in the Wicker Park, Logan Square area, Smoke Daddy, Westtown Bakery, places like that. I do miss, I gotta say, I lived up there, early 2000s, right in that area, and I do miss the player parking lot right next to Wrigley Field, so you could just wait by the fence right on Clark right there, and you could see the players coming out. You could yell at them, you could wave to them or heckle them. The McDonald's parking lot, I miss the McDonald's parking lot across the street right at Clark and Addison. I don't know, I didn't really go to McDonald's a lot, but I just thought the, you know, they were always selling stuff in the parking lot. And don't get me wrong, people are still selling things on the street, like t-shirts and baseball caps and things like that. It was just pretty in your face. I don't know. I mean, I'll get used to it, I'm sure. So many of us have. But, you know, there was a story in the Sun-Times earlier in the week that maybe the owners should kind of focus more on the baseball as opposed to making it like an amusement park around Wrigley Field. That might be something we should look into for all of us Cubs fans. But we'll still go. We'll still check out Wrigley, because once you're in there, it is a lot of fun. It was a beautiful day. We had really good seats. So, look, let's focus on that. Let's focus on what we're doing on the show today. Action-packed, we'll be getting an update on Chicago's tax increment financing program. If that sounds boring, it is not. It's important. So stay tuned for that. And hey, it's Pride Month, so we will talk about the importance of learning LGBTQ history, and we will find out more about the Legacy Project based in Chicago. It's all coming up on the show today. Don't go anywhere. Hoist your $13 beer that you buy in the stadium. Community engagement and organizing are important in our civic lives and responsibilities. These are also important in our democracy. The Civic Lab works to preserve democracy, and it's based right here in Chicago. Tom Tresser is the co-founder of the Civic Lab. He's also a civic educator and public defender. And you could check out the Civic Lab online, civiclab.us. Tom Tresser is with us once again here on Outside the Loop. Tom, welcome back to the show, man.
Hey, Mike, thanks for bringing me on your air. It's so friendly.
We'll keep it that way. You know, it's nice, friendly conversation. I like that. So, look, you have been talking about these things called TIF districts, TIF, Tax Increment Financing Districts, for years. And you and I have been talking about this issue for years. And we'll get more into it. But just briefly, I always ask you to do this, just briefly, the elevator pitch. Like, you run into someone in the elevator and they say, Tom, what's a TIF? How does it work?
What's a TIF? It's a thing created by a city. It's a district, so that means it's lines on a map, and it's done in the name of economic development. That's air quotes here, big air quotes. And what happens is, once that district is created, the city will steal or extract all the property tax revenue, new property tax revenues above the amount of taxes that those properties were created, inside the district. Before the TIF was created. So you have a TIF district being created on the west side or wherever. There's 1,000 properties in it. They throw $1,000 off in property tax, and then the district is created. And then for 23 years, there's this meticulous accounting. Every penny of new property tax value above that 1,000, which we call the base, is collected by the TIF and squirreled away in a secret account in the mayor's basement, and is not available to the public for public uses. So it's a giant slush fund. I guess that's the easiest way I can describe it.
Yeah. So if you're, let's say your property is worth $1,000, which no place in Chicago is, but it's worth $1,000, then it goes up next year to $1,005. That $5 is put away in a fund. And you multiply that by however many properties are in this district. And then this, as you say, slush fund is created. How many TIF districts currently are there in Chicago?
Well, the Civic Labs TIF Illumination Project has been tracking that since 2008. And we come out with a report every year. You can find it at tiffreports.com. But the answer is at 2020, 136 TIF districts.
Mm-hmm. And how much money are we talking about there?
Well, so again, this operation of skimming, if you will, think of Vegas, skimming money off the top for the mob. They collected about $825 million. Wow. That's how much they skimmed off the top. And the other number that we always release at when we do our reports is how much money is left in the TIF accounts at the end of the year. So think of each TIF. These 136 TIFs have having a checkbook, if you can think about it that way. There's a balance at the beginning of the year. Money comes into it from this nefarious process. They spend money, and then at the end of the year, there's a balance. Okay. We add up all the TIF accounts at the end of the year, and at the end of 2020, there was a little under $2 billion in property taxes sitting in the TIF accounts.
Wow, $2 billion. So I know you've said Chicago is not broke, and there you go. We've got this money.
That's right.
Just sitting there. And, okay, look, this is supposed to be for economic development and blighted areas. We know we've talked about how the money doesn't usually go there. So you have been talking about the really, as you say, nefarious process here when it comes to TIFs. And despite all that, despite your efforts at the Civic Lab, there is right now a proposed TIF district, the Cicero Stevenson TIF. This is towards the southwest border of Chicago. The alderman of the area of the 22nd Ward is on board. This is the around the site of the LeClaire Court housing complex. And I watched a video online about this. Sounds like a good idea. What am I missing here? Because the sales pitch for this kind of thing, these TIF districts, sounds really good.
Yeah, well, it's like civic crack, these city people cannot wean themselves off this corrupt racist practice, and they will throw in once in a while a project that is worthwhile, something that should be built, whether it's affordable homes or a new library or maybe a boathouse, for the park district, things that the city needs, and the Civic Lab is not opposed to. It's just how it gets done. So in this particular TIF, they want to So support a clout-connected charter school. This is called the Academy for Global Citizenship. It got put in to the state budget because of Mike Madigan's clout. You know, he's heading to prison. And this is a $31 million earmark inside the state's 2021 capital program for this charter school, which is in the TIF district. So, again, am I against schools? No. But if you want to build a private school, you should build it without public money, first of all, and it certainly doesn't deserve TIF money on top of a state light item. So when you see these kinds of things pop up across the TIF landscape, you just have to blow the whistle and call foul play. And so the TIFs pervert any kind of democratic, open, and just planning process. So if the city needs more affordable housing, that's fine. Put it in the budget as a line item. Let's have hearings. Where should the housing be built, or where should the parks be built? You know, an open process, and let's have it in the line item for the city budget where it's open and available to scrutiny as it should be. So the short answer is you might get a beneficial project once in a while through a terribly racist and corrupt process.
And you mentioned that this is a racist process, and I believe that's because you're arguing that the communities that are negatively impacted here are black and brown communities. In other words, the money that's supposed to go to these areas, maybe to fix some of that blight, to reinvigorate these local economies, that money is going elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, like I say, TIFs have taken $10 billion off the table since they were created in 1986. $10 billion. And, you know, about 56% of that should have gone to our public schools, which, again, predominantly serve black and brown children. So it's a racist operation. And the black and brown communities have been sandblasted, been redlined, predatory lending, houses underwater, blockbusting, and then the closing of public schools. I mean, it's been one disaster. Oh, and then COVID has hit black and brown communities horribly, you know, people of color dying 4 to 5 times the rates of whites. The life expectancy from the north to the south sides, affluent white to modest black communities, is 12 years. All this is well known in Chicago. And we place TIFs and the way public money has been taken away from black and brown communities as very instrumental in that sad racist narrative. So, yeah, we at the Civic Lab call for the abolition of TIFs, and our argument can be found at www.endtiffsnow.org. It's all laid out there.
Recently, you were co-leading a workshop focusing on community organizing here, and that's an important term, and especially when we talk about TIFs. But community organizing, what does that term mean, and why is that important to our democracy?
Well, bottom line is organizing, which, by the way, modern community organizing, as it's usually expressed, was born here in Chicago in the late 30s, early 40s, by a guy named Saul Alinsky.
Sure.
Who started something called the Industrial Area Foundation, which is still going well across the country with many, many locations, including two large organizations right here, United Action for Power and Justice, right here in this county with two affiliates. But one way to talk about it is to ask yourself the question is, how do the powerless get power? And that is really what organizing is all about. It's bringing people together, usually neighbors or people in some, you know, area that they have something in concern. It could be, you know, a neighborhood or maybe an issue that is uniting people. And the power structure doesn't want to listen to them. It doesn't want to take care of them. It doesn't matter what the injustice is. It doesn't matter how blatant the evil is, that an average person would say, that sucks, that's horrible, that's got to go. That kind of gut check is not what organizing is about. Organizing is about uniting with power in numbers around mutual self-interest, and then self-directing or using your own power of intellect and asking questions and creativity to find a solution, and then to demand that solution and to work tirelessly until you get some justice. And there's so many great examples around Chicago and America of neighbors and people who've done just that. You know, it's the basis of all movement building. I mean, whatever the movement is, whether it's the right to vote or fair housing or gay marriage or whatever that big issue is, the power structure never wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Right. They didn't care what the right was or what the wrong was. They just said, we're happy with the way things are. Go F yourself. So when we teach organizing at Civic Lab, we are very well grounded in all what we call the cycle of liberation and what we call the ladder of participation. And we teach that, people are experts in their own lives. This is also a tenet of popular education. People may have heard of Paulo Freire, the great South American educator and liberationist. And we steal little bits from many playbooks. Ella Baker, the great African-American organizer from the 50s and 60s, a master organizer, teaches us what she calls the spade workers of social justice, the people who do not make the headlines, but who toil away, you know, in different communities and organizations. And so what we try to do is to create more spade workers and give them the skills, knowledge, and attributes needed to win in public life. And it is teachable, you know, and we think, you have to go to civic school sometimes, or sometimes we say go to the civic gym, right? And
right.
Build your civic muscles. This is not something you just can pick up on your own or do on your own. There's a craft. There's an art and a science to it.
Right, and we have to learn that. And I think, to your point, there are great examples of this in Chicago, but I'm glad that you do these programs through the Civic Lab where we can learn this, because sometimes in communities, especially marginalized communities, we feel that, oh boy, we might not have the power because who cares what I have to say? But really, when we get together and get organized and create a message and put some pressure on those in power, then that's okay. We can do that in a democracy. Yeah. That's where the change starts to happen.
Yeah, pressure, you know, the great orator and the great general of the civil rights movement and writer and liberator, Frederick Douglass, said power never concedes anything without a demand. It never has and it never will. So that is the tenet of our teaching. And we've got a full day civic organizing school coming up in July, as well as a workshop on using data for social change. Also coming up in July is the famous TIFF 101,
yes.
Organizing for Economic Justice. And all that will be on our website at civiclab.us. People can go and check it out.
All right, lots going on here when we talk about getting involved in the community and learning what's going on and demanding change. Check out civiclab.us for the Civic Lab, working to preserve democracy and getting us involved in that preservation. Tom Tresser is the co-founder of Civic Lab. He's a civic educator and public defender. Tom, I always enjoy our conversations. I always get fired up after I talk to you. So hopefully we're all fired up to make a change.
Hey, listen, you listeners out there, get busy. This work is not going to be done by itself, even inside of a COVID or a depressed time. We have to get out and get busy for justice. Or as John Lewis used to say, we got to make some beautiful trouble, you all.
That's right, Tom. I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Pride Month, and one of the ways we can celebrate is to learn about the legacy of the LGBTQ community. So many individuals in this community have made a positive impact on our society. The Legacy Project is a Chicago-based cultural and educational nonprofit dedicated to researching and promoting the contributions LGBTQ people have made to history and culture. Victor Salvo is the founder and executive director of the Legacy Project. They are online, legacyprojectchicago.org. Victor, nice to talk to you. Welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike, and happy Pride to you.
Happy Pride to you. You know, it's been about 3 years since the last time you and I have talked on the radio.
Yes.
And boy, a lot has happened, and plus a pandemic in there. So it's good to catch up. But I just briefly, again, for folks who don't know, so your organization, what you're doing here is you're working to highlight important contributions of LGBTQ people in history. And right there, okay, like someone might say that's not maybe a radical idea, but in a way it is, because this history isn't really celebrated, is it?
It's not celebrated because it's largely unknown. The truth of the matter is that for a variety of reasons, the very contributions we're talking about have been redacted from conventional history. And there are a great many people of tremendous influence whose names people will recognize that they simply did not know were actually part of the LGBTQ community in their time, even though those particular letters would not have had any meaning to them. You know, those are contemporary terms, but there are many individuals that are currently, you know, already studied in school who were LGBTQ, and with them being removed from history, it has created a tremendous information vacuum that we're really just trying to address.
So the Legacy Project, again, legacyprojectchicago.org is the website. You have what's called the Legacy Walk, and this is something that we can actually go out and do and learn from. This is in the North Halsted, formerly Boys Town neighborhood, and up on Halsted, the street in Lakeview. There are those rainbow pylons that I think have sort of defined or helped to define that neighborhood geographically. And we all maybe are aware of those big rainbow pylons, but there are plaques. If you look at street level, there are plaques at the bottom of those pylons. And it's actually a landmark, this Legacy Walk. Just tell us briefly what this is all about.
Well, the pylon streetscape was actually created in 1998. It was an idea of Mayor Daley's, which is something that most people don't know, and I always want to give him a shout out about that. The Legacy Walk came along in 2012. We began work actually in 2008, and it took a number of years to come to fruition, but the first bronze memorials were attached in 2012, and then more were added in continuing years. And in 2018, we closed the circle, as we say. There are 40 available spaces, and all 40 spaces were filled with these large, they're plaques, they're bronze plaques, 18 inches by 24 inches, that feature roughly 300 to 350 words explaining the contributions of certain individuals in a variety of different fields of contribution. It is international and multicultural, so it's not based solely on Chicago or on the United States, to kind of clear that up for folks. And it continues. People that are extremely surprising, and others who may be obscure, but who did something extremely important that people will recognize.
And if we want to participate in this Legacy Walk, we can, right? So if we go to the website, this is actually like a walking tour that folks can go on.
Correct. It's open air. Obviously, it's outdoors. And we get, honestly, millions of visitors a year come because North Halsted is such a tourist attraction. This is high tourism season, as you can imagine. So we've already got 12 guided tours booked that we conduct. But those are, you know, prearranged with us, with a docent who goes out with the group. But individuals can certainly just come and stroll the street like any other street and take it in for themselves.
And so that website, again, is legacyprojectchicago.org. If you would like to join up, if you'd like to go, of course, anyone could check it out, because as we're saying here, this is on Halsted and Lakeview. Anyone can walk down the street and take in the Legacy Project, these plaques, educating us about LGBTQ people in history. But if you want, again, that guided tour, go to legacyprojectchicago.org. So the importance of something like this, I know that the walk is just one thing that you do, Victor, with the Legacy Project. Mm-hmm. But, you know, do you see when people maybe learn about this, there are some light bulbs that go off when we're exposed to this history that maybe we never were before, that people kind of say, oh, wow, maybe I'll think differently about the LGBTQ community. Do you see any of that, sort of those light bulb moments?
Oh, absolutely. Perhaps not as much on the Legacy Walk, because we're, you know, obviously in a neighborhood with a large LGBTQ population, hence the pylons. But the Legacy Wall, our traveling installation, which has been to 40 cities in the United States, is almost always dropped down in the middle of some place that has no idea what to expect. And that's when I get to spend a great deal of time talking with parents and even with teachers, as well as students and just, you know, casual people who come by. And the one common thing that is said over and over and over again is, why weren't we told? And that is where that light bulb comes on, because this is really about a conversation that is long overdue, because it's not only about the fact that the information has been removed, or about the fact that our mission is to put that one sentence back into the biography somebody else thought was important enough it had to be left out, but it's really about the impact of how history is taught and how our perception of the world is influenced by our understanding of history. And the fact that LGBTQ people have been removed from that narrative, like I said, for a variety of reasons, has created an information vacuum which makes this community extraordinarily easy to marginalize. And as adults, we may learn how to navigate that. But for kids who go through their entire education without learning a single positive thing about those who are LGBTQ, who are like them, while at the same time being exposed to epithets in the hallway being hurled at them and potentially negative reinforcement coming from within their own families, this kind of information is actually a lifeline for kids who are looking to understand the context of their feelings and their identity as it is emerging in that natural time, which is why I'm very proud of the fact that Illinois has the contract probably would not be the right word, but we're working with the Illinois State Board of Education to craft the new LGBTQ inclusive public school curriculum, which is mandated by law since Governor Pritzker signed the law and went into effect in July 2020. So all of these people that you can see on the Legacy Walk now also have lesson plans that are part of school curriculum.
You know, that's something that's worth mentioning, and maybe some of us don't know, but we should, that Illinois, by law, is mandating LGBTQ education in schools. That, and what I mean by that is that students need to learn a more complete history and learn about the impact of this community on who we are as a people. So, you, like you say, have been working with the state to develop curriculum that schools can use so that the next generation can be more aware, more educated, and again, more students seeing themselves in the curriculum.
Absolutely. And it also tones down the rhetoric. It improves school climate. It has been shown through study after study that when a curriculum is inclusive for these kids, it actually brings down all the incidences of bullying within a school, not just anti-LGBTQ bullying, but all bullying, because it creates an environment of tolerance. And, you know, we're not teaching about necessarily the history of the movement particularly. We're actually, our material is specifically designed to be seamlessly integrated into existing school curriculum. So if you're talking about World War II, there are people from World War II, Alan Turing, the man who broke the Nazi Enigma code and is considered the father of computer science, was a gay man. And there are World War II heroes. You know, NATO was founded by a gay man named Sumner Wells. Jane Addams, the mother of social work, was a lesbian. There are so many different things within all the subject matter in school, not just art and theater, as many people might think would be the case, but in every field imaginable, medicine and all of that. There are individuals that we have materials prepared for that a teacher can go to our website and actually use a search filter mechanism that we have set up, and they can plug in either, you know, the grade in school or the person's name or the subject matter or even the individual's school code, because Illinois has education education standard codes, that we have all developed a matrix to actually link our people at four different age levels, from K through 2, 3 through 5, 6 through 8, 9 through 12. Those teachers can actually do a search and pull up the education materials, which illuminate how that person fits in to the curriculum that we already know these teachers are teaching. So it makes it possible to seamlessly integrate this. And we must be doing something right, because our web hits went from 5,000 a month normally a few years back to now over 40,000 a month. So that has got to be a direct result of the education thing. It's the only major thing that changed on the website.
I mean, that's really wonderful to have that. Again, the website's legacyprojectchicago.org. And, you know, we're talking about education here, Victor, and you know, since the last time you were on this show 3 years ago, we've seen a rise in anti-LGBTQ laws, either passed in some states, attempted, or are pending in state legislatures. And many of these laws have to do with education. And specifically, you can't do this, you can't teach this, you can't mention gay, you can't mention lesbian, you can't mention LGBTQ. I guess the question here is, what the heck is happening? You know, I look on one hand, like what you're doing with the Legacy Project, and it's such great work and important work. And then on the other hand, it seems like everywhere else you look, there are these laws that are being passed about, well, you can't do that in schools. We're going to omit this story in some schools. And what's going on here?
Well, we're, of course, very fortunate to live in Illinois, which is a progressive beacon in the middle of the country, and in my estimation, personally, probably the most progressive state in the country. That said, the types of laws that you're talking about are coming primarily from areas which are less progressive. And it's not the first time these "don't say gay" types of things have happened. It floated around as an idea a few years back and it kind of went away, and now it's returned again, piggybacking on the sort of anti-trans environment that Texas has been pushing. There's a couple of ways to look at it. The fact that the people who are making these laws feel that they are doing the right thing is a direct result of the fact that they themselves have not experienced this education. Because in the absence of actual empirical knowledge about what talking about gay people actually means, people will simply fill in whatever they want to say. And for an audience which is also equally ignorant of that content, they're all prepared to agree and say, of course, we have to protect our children. You can't say this. And the truth of the matter is that you're talking about someone like Josephine Baker or Father Michael Judge or Barbara Jordan, Congresswoman, or Tchaikovsky, or Sally Ride, the astronaut. These are the kinds of lives that we talk about. And these are the messages that we bring, because this is what actually saying gay means. So for those who are trying to pass these laws, it's because they don't know. They themselves are a direct product of that failure in the education system to deal with this. So in a way, you can't blame them for not knowing something they were never allowed to be taught. Just let's just be perfectly honest about that. Where I truly object to it is the politicization of it. Because these laws are actually, I have been around as an activist for a very long time. I remember the flurry under George Bush of all those amendments that were being put on ballots across the country to try and stop same-sex marriage from happening by making it, you know, against the laws of individual states to outlaw it. There's a political motivation behind it, and it's called getting people to the polls. And that's the main reason why these laws are coming out now. It has very little to do with the actual intent behind the law. The people who are pushing them are actually trying to set up a political environment that ensures turnout among their most, you know, ardent supporters. And they're counting on people to not have this knowledge, because the truth of the matter is, as I've said, when people actually experience it, the light bulb does go off, which makes this particular knowledge extremely dangerous politically for those who are trying to keep a lid on it. because once this comes out, people change. And when they change, their voting patterns may change. So that, to me, is really what this is actually all about. It has almost nothing whatsoever to do with protecting children.
Well, as we're seeing here, it is vitally important for everyone to get educated, have the most complete education possible. And that involves learning stories about people who maybe were traditionally marginalized. And I know that, again, at the Legacy Project, Victor, you are working for more inclusivity, more education, and just a better understanding and appreciation of the LGBTQ history, because it is also part of our larger history in this country. The website is legacyprojectchicago.org, and Victor Salvo is the founder and executive director of the Legacy Project. Victor, I appreciate you talking to us today. Thank you for your time. Keep doing what you're doing, and happy Pride.
Happy Pride, Gigi. It was my pleasure.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 817 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the program. I really do appreciate it. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer in the studio today. And hey, I want you to have a fantastic week. And I will talk to you again next time, right here on Outside the Loop.